Okay, Happy New Year, everyone. We still have a few sessions in Introduction to Philosophy of Technology course. Today, I'm going to give as a kind of example of... basically, all these lectures now in January are examples of philosophy of technology rather than the systematic stuff we did before. So this time I'm going to do an overview of my research on romanticism and technology. If you want to know more about it, there's an entire lecture course on it. But it gives people who didn't do the course an overview. Next time we have an external guest, Nolan Gertz, giving a lecture on Hegel and technology. I like this because I'm not a Hegel expert, and I really like the combination Hegel and philosophy of technology. It can bring in, for example, more dialectical thinking, critical theory, and so on. And then we finish with Michael Funk on technology and warfare to connect to a contemporary topic, drones, for example. That's also relevant in discourses in philosophy of technology. So today, romanticism and technology. So romanticism is usually not talked about it in connection to technology. It's usually talked about in connection with literature, art. It's seen as a cultural movement starting end of 18th century, and then there are different accounts. I mean, some people say it goes to 1830, others say it goes to the mid 19th century. The way I interpret it in my book is that it continues until today. So there's wide variety there on how long it is. But let's say that it's mainly thought of as an artistic cultural movement starting end of the 18th century until, say, mid 19th century. It's a reaction against the objectivism of science against what Weber called disenchantment. I will talk about that later. And the reaction then goes towards the opposite of what it takes to be rationality and science. And it goes towards subjective feeling, it goes towards passion, horror, melancholy, all kind of things that romantics felt were missing in the scientism and classicism of the time. It's also very much in favor of personal freedom against a tradition that's seen as oppressive to the individual. And there's an exploration of new experiences, something that people often associate with the 60s, 70s, drugs and rock and roll and so on. But that was actually already there at the Romantic. The Romantics already did this. Not rock and roll, of course, but the drugs. So in art, then, one can look at the specific movements in literature, for example, in painting. There are also links with the political movements. I won't go into detail there. But I want to stress here that the usual idea of romanticism is to keep it at a distance because it's seen as a movement of the past. It's not seen as something that has to do with our lives. So it's something for your free time, let's say, for cultural matters in the sense of something that you do in your leisure time. You go to the museum, you're busy with art yourself, but it's not seen as a very serious topic. And it's also often connected with nostalgia with going back to the past. So someone is said to be romantic, meaning then you want to go back to the past. You don't want to live today. You are nostalgic. I think that romanticism is not dead and that it's an important strand of thinking also to look at when we want to better understand our relation to technology. Again, this is against the normal view because usually romanticism is seen in opposition to technology. Technology is seen as belonging to the more cold instrumentalist side of modernity, and the machine of it, the system, and so on. Romantics, one could argue in this view, exactly wanted to get away from that. And so technology at first sight seems to be everything romantics wanted to be away, to go away from. They wanted life, passion and love, self-expression, nature, spirituality, authenticity. And so technology doesn't seem to offer this. But if we look actually at the history of romanticism and technology, you see that it's not that easy. There was fear and fascination with technology, and that their romanticism mixes with technology in various ways. And so this I will, during the lecture now, put in more detail. Because what I argued in the book is that this fusion of technology and romanticism was there in the 19th century, but also today, when we use smartphones, for example, when we use the internet. In this lecture, I will focus mainly on the internet, but if you want to know more, then next term there's the Romanticism and Technology lectures. So, what will I do today? First, I talk about Romanticism against the machine, about the very opposition I already presented, but then more historical and internal history of ideas. Then I will give examples of how there is also what I call Romanticism with the machine, where Romanticism and technology are not opposed. And then in the third part, I will say about the internet as a romantic space. So that's the plan for today. Romanticism against the machine. So even apart from the historical discussion, the associations we have with the term romanticism are always defined in opposite to science and technology. So romanticism is associated with feeling, imagination, nostalgia, backward looking, dreamy, and so on, whereas technology is seen as a materialization of objective rationality, of cold science, seen from the romantic side, from being the opposite of dreamy, from being concerned with the real world. So, in general, one could say that also conceptually they are often seen as opposed. It's also often an assumption made by people who embrace contemporary technology. so it's not only about the past here, but also today. And if we look at where this conflict, this tension between technology and romanticism comes from, a good place to start is Max Weber. Max Weber, many of you may know, his ideas about enchantment versus disenchantment. So Max Weber introduced the opposition that science and technology have disenchanted the world, have made the world less magic, less religious also. This is somehow this opposition between science and technology on the one hand and religion and other things. This opposition and this very claim about disenchantment has taken deep roots in modern thinking, and it's very difficult to get rid of that. Even if we disagree, for example, with the disenchantment thesis, it's still something that we have to respond to. I'm not going to go so much into the sources of Weber. So Weber goes back to Schiller. It is interesting to know this because Schiller is, of course, a romantic. Schiller complaining about a world without gods, about the de-divinization of nature. So Weber takes this idea, and it also gives you a hint that the very opposition I've been talking about and Weber's very claim about disenchantment, that it's actually a romantic claim itself. Kind of an extra layer to it. Now, if we actually look at Weber's text, Science and Suffocation, there is the opposition, but it's also a little bit more complex. So Weber does not really argue that science and religion are necessarily opposed. He says that Protestant Puritan scientists wanted to show the path to God, and he makes all kind of links there between science and religion. But on the other hand, he still says that today no one believes this, that we no longer see meaning in the universe, that science has become irreligious. So that's the slightly more complex claim Weber makes. But it's interesting to note here that apparently science and religion, for example, can go together. What the romantics say, but also the anti-romantics who say like we have to go to objective science, that they're both denying this. But I think it's convincing that Weber shows that scientists are not necessarily irreligious. They can have very specific religious ideas, and then use science in the framework of that. In any case, in the text as a whole, science is contrasted with religious experience, and especially when Weber says that science cannot give an answer to the questions about the meaning of life. So there's again the contrast. He doesn't claim that science is value-free, and again, also it doesn't claim that science is religion-free or something. In general, there is this, especially if we look at the disenchantment claim, there is the contrast is in place, so romanticism against the machine. There's always this play, if you read the text, disenchantment is itself, one could see disenchantment as is itself a kind of stage in a religious progression, in a religious change. But then he comes back to secularization, is there disenchantment? In the Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, he speaks about the iron cage, which means that human beings are, through science and technology, human beings become part of a system, don't have this freedom that's so valued by romantics. Cogs in the machine is another metaphor. So there it's clear that there's a link between rationality and the iron cage. And one could say, like, well, this is a part of disenchantment. So this is something that romantics then can react against. So Weber speaks, for example, of the economic order also as being about technical and economic conditions of machine production. And so he already speaks about machines and sees the human being as unfree because of this. So this way of looking at modernity is itself romantic because it uses these oppositions. The Romantics exactly introduced this contrast. And one could say that Romantics give us the tools to create a gap between science and religion, between technology, spontaneity, machines and humanity. So especially if we're going to look later in the lecture to what I call romantic science, then you see that it's possible to look at science in a different way, in a non-romantic way. Or it's possible to look at science and romanticism together, and so in a way that's doesn't have the tensions. So, romanticism with the machine, what could this mean? Well, if we look at fiction, a very famous story is that of Mary Shelley, Frankenstein. Today you would call it science fiction. And you see very well in the story that all kind of elements which romantics liked, and also the especially the Gothic romantics, that they are there, and at the same time that they're that she responds to scientific developments of her time. So, if we look at the science of Mary Shelley's day, then you see that what happens there is the so-called second scientific revolution. Magnetism has been discovered, electricity is discovered, is used in all kind of experiments and performances. This was made possible by technology, and there was new equipment which made possible these new experiments with electricity and magnetism. There's also at the time of the second scientific revolution, collaboration between industry and science, something that's today very obvious, but before it wasn't there. If you look at how these scientists were thinking, there's not so much going on what some romantics then call the cold science, but there's actually romantic science, warm science going on. So let's go more into details. First of all, the scientist itself, the thirst for knowledge itself is was often connected not so much with some idea of I want to only just discover the laws of nature, but there was the idea of inspiration and intuition, and often the myth of Eureka is used for that. So the scientist was seen as a genius who suddenly comes to ideas. And by the way, often today even this idea is often still there. People think that very smart scientist comes up suddenly with an idea, and this is the way science works. Children get this idea in all kind of narratives. The view of a scientist as someone who receives ideas by inspiration, by intuition, by mystical vision, even is there. And also the notion of nature, not so much as something passive, but more as an active participant in the process, in the epistemological process. And there you see, so it's on the one hand, it's a technological process, because you have instruments like a voltaic battery or an air pump are used. On the other hand, there's nature, but nature is fluid dynamic. So if you think about electricity, for them this was at the time it was a kind of mysterious force that was flowing through things, and nature becomes not so static as in Newton, but becomes itself fluid and dynamic. And in this way, the you could say mind and matter come much closer in this kind of romanticism, because the nature becomes more fluid, but the human mind is also fluid and mysterious, and so both come together. And there's a lot of interest in discovering places in a very romantic way, as going more remote, going in the abyss of your soul. So the mind is mysterious, but also the whole earth has still mysterious corners. So one could say that there is one great journey that goes deep in the mind and also far away to the edges of the earth, so to speak. So this was all science and at the same time romantic. Here are some more examples of how this looked like in practice. So the hunting of comets as kind of romantic exercise. The sky, you could say that the universe of stars for them was it's ghost, because the light reaches us much longer after the star has existed. So it's a kind of ghost hunting also. Flying itself also as a romantic technology to create sublime experiences. Exhibitions, or rather expeditions, that should be in Africa. Think about the novel, Joseph Conrad's novel Heart of Darkness, where there's this idea also darkness was a very very romantics always had an interest in darkness, in what's mysterious, in the unknown. And so the idea of the book is that the protagonist goes into Africa, into the darkness, into the unknown. There's this mystery, there's violence and so on. And so this was typical romantic interest, even if the book is late, published later. Chemistry, also chemistry. Nowadays we think about chemistry not as romantic, but for the romantic scientists, it was interesting to be busy with this kind of mysterious forces and elements that you cannot see, and it's the invisible. And now we get closer again to Mary Shelley, the dead bodies that get revived by batteries. So of course they're not revived, but there's an attempt made to revive them. There's also the idea of, like, bringing life and death together, animating the dead matter, and you see that scientists of the day, like Aldini and Ritter, they were seen as scientists, and at the same time they did things which we now would say are more some religious belief or so. But for them, there was no opposition. So the important thing is not so much what we think about them here, but how they saw themselves, and how romanticism and science mixed in the way they thought. And if we then compare this also with romantic sources of Schelling, then you see also that they also saw the natural world as of invisible powers and energies, and so scientists then try to understand and reveal these powers, work with these powers using instruments, using technology. And so in all these cases, if one actually looks at the romantic science of the day, it's all mediated by and made possible by technologies. It's not an immaterial kind of romanticism, but a material romanticism. And this we also see in Frankenstein, where there's the interest in the unseen, in the carnal, which was missing in the Protestantism that abolished the monasteries and all the pleasures that were seen as more Catholic by Protestants. There's interest in the mystery of life, the psyche, and of course the animation of the corpse. The monster of Frankenstein is first dead and gets revived. And one can directly link that to the scientific experiments of the day, which were used by Shelley in her imagination to create this romantic and gothic science in her novel. Now, this reading is different from the usual one. Usually it's read as a warning against science and technology, but actually in contemporary scholarship it's recognized that her message was more subtle, that it was a writing against a very specific science and technology, one that became divorced from life, one that was no longer interested in people, in family, in society, but that stood on its own, became isolated from that, also became unethical, one could say, where there are no duties towards persons and towards society anymore. So it's very much a comment on that kind of science, a romantic comment on that science, but a romanticism that tries to connect science and society. Think about today, where you have science and society studies, where both are brought together again. One could say that this had a romantic spark. Reanimation already said. Also, the romantic idea of that science and technology is mechanical, but here it's a specific science and technology. So she's not against science and technology itself, but one could say that she argued for a romantic science, a science that would actually do good to society, a science that would not be only for isolated men, but also for women and so on. So this is, I think, an interesting reading of the novel. And if you look at the text, you see also very much the romanticism in there, but also at the same time the interest in technology. For example, the quote, "I saw the pale student of unhallowed arts kneeling beside the thing he had put together. I saw the hideous phantasm of a man stretched out, and then on the working of some powerful engine," and so she really mentioned technology here, "show signs of life and stir with an uneasy half-vital motion." So in half-vital, romantics are really interested in this crossing of boundaries, something that's then celebrated in the 20th century by post-humanists. It's life and death at the same time. So this kind of merger. So also the reanimation is by means of electricity, which is itself a mysterious force that scientists try to understand. And one could say that Victor Frankenstein in the novel represents the romantic gothic scientist of the time, but also the scientist Mary Shelley then wants to criticize, the one that goes for isolation, because remember that the Frankenstein so-called monster becomes a monster only after Frankenstein abandons it. Yeah, so it's not a monster before, but there's abandonment, there's isolation, there's a separation, and this is what Mary Shelley criticized. So one could say her novel is a kind of romantic gesture in response to an already romantic science. And that's the reading I propose. I could say more about that. There are whole stories about her connections than with scientists and poets. We can say more about religion and technology. In any case, it's clear that here there are connections between technology and romanticism. It's possible to do this. Now, is this only something of the 19th century? Is this only this Victorians, as they would say in England, that had this romantic and gothic fantasies, or that even practiced this romantic science? And do we today have a non-romantic science? And do we today have technology that's non-romantic? But the claim I make in my book is that we have romanticism, and in the book I focus more on contemporary technologies, but that I leave for the lectures. I want to first, as a basis, many contemporary technologies are internet-based, so I thought, like, let's look at the internet as a romantic technology, to show that this is not only about revitalization of corpses in the 19th century, it's about also about us. And here I also go a bit back in time to the 90s, where the internet was still new, and a discourse then developed about cyber romanticism, and so the internet as romantic. So let's start with that. How did the internet create new romantic spaces? This is still about other technologies, like video games and robots, but I won't talk about it. I will talk about the internet. But just to give you an idea, I put it in that one. If you look at the discourse of robotics, for example, one can see also connections to what we just said about Frankenstein. But now, not Frankenstein, but the internet. So if one looks at the birth of the internet, it's born in what's sometimes called the military-industrial academic complex. Academic, because in the US academia is very much connected also to the military and the industry. And so internet developed at various points, but here I zoom in on the countercultural revolution, mainly in California, where interestingly you see that early pioneers in computing, that they were influenced by romantic ideas, and not directly always 19th century romantic ideas, but more ideas they picked up from counterculture. So 1960s, 70s is a time of the hippies and similar movements and people, where self-expression becomes important, creativity, rebellion, exploration. all kind of values which we now think are pretty standard, or which we think are have always been there, that that we can express ourselves, or that we should express ourselves, that that we should try to be creative and so on. Well, these are I would say relatively recent ideas that we inherited from 60s, 70s, and that at the time also connected to technology. So it's born in what one could say this the system, this industrial military system, but it's connected with people that were playing with technologies, that were doing DIY, do it yourself with technologies, tinkering with technologies, building their own computer, for example. And at the same time, they were influenced by hippie ideas. And if you look at the literature about the internet later, in the 90s, you see that there are certain metaphors that still refer, for example, to the American context with frontier and cowboy, but also that in general that celebrate the values that were there in the 60s and 70s. In the 90s, this becomes then a cyber romanticism, where internet became a space where you could be yourself, where you could explore new worlds, all kind of things romantics want to do. So a space for self-expression. Think also about later Second Life, for example, as a way to create your own avatar, be yourself, play with identities. But there it was already a liberation, so to speak, to be going into a different world, to not just stick with the world we can see, but there was a new space called cyberspace created. There are different layers and connections here, because the very, I said cowboy is a kind of connection to the American context, but of course cowboy itself is also, the whole concept is a romantic myth. It's about liberation from the old world, going into the wild, to the edge. So this very much, and it's of course also taken, this kind of thinking is taken up in rock culture, also in more generally, for example. So the idea of the lonely individual, exploring things, seeking a terra nova, a new world, dealing with all kind of forces there. Programmers also, and then later in the 90s, internet users started to see themselves as artists and rebels. So here the very idea of the, how should I say it, basically technology became cool, became something that is not buried in this military-industrial complex context. It's not something boring having to do only with calculation, because a computer before, in the imagination of people, was seen as a calculator, a very word computer. And later with the internet, already earlier a little bit, but mainly with the internet, then computing becomes something that one can do as a rebel, for example, as a hacker. So they were computer scientists and so-called technical people, but at the same time there was a romantic element in it already at the time when there was the craft of building of hardware, which is now, by the way, today taken up again by people who want to go back to that and build computer hardware with their hands, do in workshops and so on. So one could say hackers and programmers became romantic artists, creation, individual creation becomes important. And it's also something that can be done outside the context of industry or of the military. You can do it at home, everywhere. So we see the image of the isolated hacker, or the image indeed of Jobs and Steve Jobs and others who made and sold computers in their garage. At least that's the myth, the romantic myth about it. But it's a very important myth, because this is how these people saw themselves. They saw themselves as liberating themselves from the big companies, as doing something that has nothing to do with big companies or the state, but they themselves could do it in communities, in workshops. No big bureaucratic institution needed, just creative individuals who think freely. So the opposite of the romantic, for the romantics in the 19th century, was called the Philistine, and the totally non-romantic bourgeois, for example. But now, suddenly the computer programmer, who used to be seen as a very Philistine person, becomes a romantic artist. So it's a total opposite of before. The nerd, the geek, becomes cool to be that, and before it was really different. And then politically speaking, so liberation also politically, the revolution. There's an Apple commercial that plays with that, with someone with a hammer smashing away the kind of Big Brother style system. So suddenly using computers and then later using the internet was something to be against the system, to do revolution. Then it's not only after a while you see that when the internet becomes available to all kind of users, also it's not only the hacker and the programmer or the hobbyist, but it's everyone. Suddenly this romantic experience becomes available for everyone. You could see that the internet makes possible this unpredictability, and what people value in art, in creativity, is often the unpredictable. And internet provides that, because especially today, I would say, when we don't have any more things like portals and the static internet, but where the internet is so much with so much more possible, it's computing experience itself becomes a romantic journey. There's a price unpredictability. In the 90s, the term surfing is used. You surf from the one website to the other. Websites is there the main medium. Today, it's often apps that are its main medium, but then websites. And you go from one website to the other, and there's surprises. And for many people, this was very liberating. Also, especially when internet provides virtual worlds where you can forget your body, the body you maybe don't like. So you don't need to be tied to the body or to your real social relations if these are not pleasant. So there's liberating, going beyond the limits. I argue then that this is a myth, because you remain embodied always, also when you use the internet, even if that embodiment is mediated by an avatar. And also, I personally criticize a lot this kind of idea of not wanting to be imprisoned in the body. it's an old Platonic idea that the body is a prison and the body is bad. So this romanticism is part of a long Platonic program in thinking. So another element that the Romantics have is not so much Plato but Dionysus, the liberation of there we have the drugs and the rock again, but now by means of a different technology, internet. One could say that technology is used to perform Dionysian rites. You have that in the rock culture and in other musical cultures often, where technology is used to perform the rites. But now the difference is that the internet is enough. Huh? The internet can also provide this. And then today we see mixtures of that. If you go to a big festival, there's all the normal technology to produce a sound, but there are also images and all kind of digital stuff, digital and non-digital mix. So one could say that the Dionysian experience is continued but with other means. And that includes, of course, also the sex and the implants and so on. So bodily connections between humans and machines are also there. In the 90s, this is more celebrated and gets also darker forms. And then, today there's all this still, but might take on different forms now. Re-enchantment also. So the internet becomes also a space liberation in the sense that romantics typically find the world around them philistine and dull, and so they seek for fantasy, for example, to escape. And this was not only so in the 19th century, it was also so today. Internet, video games also become these enchanted spaces where there's still space for wonder. The wonder and the religion that people miss in their, as romantics, that they miss in their lives because they turned away from organized religion. But they miss something. They miss the mystery, they miss the magic. And so they look for the demons, the elves, the ghosts, and so on. So this goes from Harry Potter to today, all kind of films, for example, also. Also the internet itself, one could say that there's also a transgression of the life-death border, because if you look at the internet as a whole, then in the experience of the romantic, it can also become what McLuhan called the global embrace, and what could see as a monster that becomes life, a transgression of this dead alive border, some becomes a big mind or a big spiritual being, a almost conscious living entity. So this experience, insofar that there is an experience, is definitely a romantic one. It's definitely of romantic interest. Counterculture, I already mentioned it. So again, the drugs and the internet as two different technologies, escape from biological constraints, and escape as a clear word there. I think escape also comes back in one of the names of the browsers, Netscape. It's also escape, space, and so on, but escape is also important. But back then, that was one of the browsers. Internet as a political utopia. Liberation, I would say, also the revolution. So one could say that, together with the development of the internet, it wasn't a politically neutral event. It was also people who had a certain political idea, namely the idea that we should have, instead of big organizations, big states who oppress, as in the middle of the 20th century, we should have these communities of free individuals. In the 90s, and free is more emphasized, I would say, but and whereas in the 60s, 70s, communities is more important. But it's definitely a kind of utopia, you could say. So internet went together with utopian ideas of how we should live differently. Democracy also, so many people connected this idea of a network as a possibility for new forms of living together, as being more democratic. One can go back again to the 19th century, where also there were, of course, political romantic utopian visions of alternative social relations and political arrangements. So I see a line here from the 19th century romantics over Marx later in the 19th century to the 60s, 70s counterculture and to today. The many people see the line, of course, between Marx and counterculture in the 20th century. But I like to include those in a kind of history of romanticism, also political romanticism. There were different visions of the internet, so it's not just one vision. But one could say that one can still call them romantic. And one could say that today these meanings still play a role, even if the internet changed. Today it changed, for example, to that we use the medium of apps and so on. But in culturally speaking, there's still the romanticism there. So and when we inherit a romanticism, it also means we inherit this kind of discussions about utopia, for example. I will stop here for questions. Are there any questions for about cyber romanticism and more generally about romanticism and technology?
I agree.
And that's why I also discuss then more contemporary forms where robots, for example, are still more kind of magic and romantic. But the internet, there has been a kind of, first many people had these hopes and this utopian hopes also and had this this kind of liberation idea. But then there's the argument that corporate culture kind of took over and kind of limited our experience. And I would also say that today the internet, because we use it already for a while, it's no longer new technology. It's much less magic. It's much less interesting. And so what now then takes interest is all kind of new things, like maybe new video games or new things like augmented reality I discuss in the book, robots, the new kind of cyborgs, but not so much the internet as such anymore. So I agree with that. Nevertheless, I think we still have a little bit of this. So it's still often used as, for example, when people use the internet to do illegal things, then they see it as a kind of free space. Or when they argue that it should be free, totally free. Or the discussion about the speed of the internet, whether some users should have priority using the internet and others not. The so-called internet neutrality. This then raises questions about how do we organize this, and some people start from the more utopian original idea, yeah, the internet should be free and democratic, and others then say like, no, if I have a lot of money, I just want more speed for my people or something. So I would say it's still there, but the novelty and the magic of the internet is largely gone. Other questions? Yeah. It mainly reinstalls it in the new phenomena and technologies, but we often don't think anymore about the fact that it's still based on the internet infrastructure. And this, I also argue that this is a kind of magic itself, a kind of magic thinking, because we don't look at the material infrastructures anymore, and even the software infrastructures that we do. We only use a certain app or are in a kind of game world, but we don't think anymore about what the basis of that is. But you wouldn't have the same kind of romanticism as the lonely cowboy, for example, using the internet. But maybe the lonely cowboy goes somewhere else, and so the narratives and the romantic themes will still be there, but they will attach themselves to new technologies, new software, new things. Internet of Things, for example, I also discuss in the book, is also a good example of a new kind of magic, where the idea that, in a way, that things can speak, that everything's that things speak to one another, create a kind of world. This is not very. Is not dissimilar from certain magical kind of world, and create a re-enchantment of the world. So, in the book, I give several examples of how today there's again new romanticism. That's why it's also called new romantic cyborgs, where cyborg stands for a metaphor of this life-death crossings, for example, machine-human configurations, and so on. If anyone still comes up with an example of today's romantic technologies, that's also useful. Space technologies, yes, absolutely, yeah. So that was already in the 70s, for example, also going to the moon. In the book, I discussed the idea by going back to Jules Verne, who already had this ideas of going to space in 19th century science fiction. And it's interesting to see that this 19th century science fiction then influenced real developments in rocket science in the beginning of the 20th century, which then were influenced war technology in the middle of the thing and space technology later. So there's a whole line there of space, and you see that some artists today, for example, are also interested in going to space. You know, going to space remains something that catches the romantic imagination. And there is also something that I didn't mention here, maybe, or maybe just on one slide, is that there's a tight connection between going to space and going on the internet in the early 90s, because the same kind of metaphors come back, and because it's seen as a new space. Like first we went to the material space or something, and then we go to the virtual space, the internet. Nowadays, I would say that there's much less. The space metaphor isn't used in that way anymore. We see the internet not anymore as a space or something. This whole idea of virtual reality is maybe less important today. And that's the case because, and that's why I use a cyborg metaphor in the book, because our technologies are much more mixed up with reality in a way. Online and offline connect all the time and merge. So that we use the technology as part of our daily lives. And so it's not anymore that using a laptop or using a phone is something that we do next to our normal life, so to speak, going in the evening, going on the internet, like, oh, now I'm free. No, it's something that's just part of our life. So that's not no longer, in that sense, it's no longer a liberation. But then there will be other digital technologies that are used for that. And I'm quite interested to see how augmented reality also will develop, because there's definitely a romantic kind of magic side to that. Suddenly, if I could in this room bring up all kind of 3D figures and things and so on, I mean, there's definitely a romantic interest there. And one that also would involve, imagine that I would do this here, right? So show an augmented, or invite someone showing an augmented reality device. Then this is quite similar to the kind of performances you would have in the 19th century, seances and experiments with electricity, where you would show the power of the technology and at the same time the magic of it. So the mystery in a way, but the technology is then always a medium. Further questions? Okay, so for those of you interested in the theme of romanticism and technology, I go in much more detail in the next course in the summer term. There I will say more about contemporary technologies. In February or March, the book should be out with MIT Press, and I can then it's easier for you to follow the course also. Okay, thanks. We'll see each other next time.